Hello, and welcome to PubCasts, an ongoing project to experiment with science communication and making research more accessible and digestible to both scientific and general audiences. PubCasts are audiobook-style recordings of peer-reviewed scientific research, read to you by the authors. I'm your host today, Dr. Hannah Harrison, and I'm joined by
Dr. Philip Loring.
This series is hosted by the Conservation of Change Lab and the Coastal Roots Project. Coastal Roots is a project led by Phil and myself and aims to connect research and storytelling about successful and novel adaptation to change in coastal communities in Canada and beyond. You can learn more about Coastal Roots by visiting our website at www.coastalroots.org and check back in with the podcast to listen to new episodes and paper recordings monthly.
These pubcasts are inspired by our passion for podcasts, for demystifying science, and the power of the human voice. Our goal is to give you, the listener, a new way to connect with research and, just as importantly, the researchers. These recordings will focus on trying to communicate a published research article in an engaging and convenient way, and we will sometimes stop to explain a concept, give a short anecdote, or emphasize a main point. Our hope is that this format will give people a new way to engage with the literature and, for the non-academics out there in particular, a way to hear about new science in an interesting and digestible way.
To keep things straightforward, you won't hear the in-text citations, long acronyms, or other details that make wading through a paper more challenging. But, like all peer-reviewed research, this work stands on the shoulders of researchers who came before. So, we strongly encourage you to visit the paper online and see the full reference list, as well as to enjoy the tables and figures that help explain some of our more interesting findings.
And of course, we would love to hear your feedback. If you'd like, please tweet your comments, questions, or suggestions, and you can find our Twitter information in the online details of this episode.
Today's paper is entitled Seen Beneath Disputes, a Transdisciplinary Framework for Diagnosing Complex Conservation Conflicts, written by Hannah L. Harrison and Philip A. Loring. This paper was published in the Journal of Biological Conservation in July of 2020. You can read the full text and see the affiliations and other details about the author at the journal's website. Introduction. Conflict over natural resource conservation is one of the most pressing social and environmental sustainability issues of our time. In a bioculturally diverse world, it is to be expected that people won't always share the same values and needs for how natural resources, both renewable and non, are developed. People's diverse motivations, priorities, and worldviews can be a source of strength and resilience to society, but when they intersect in ways that impact people's livelihoods and security, people either develop the tools and institutions to work together, or they enter problematic conflicts that can fracture communities and undermine community resilience and well-being. Indeed, while some level of conflict can be indicative of engaged resource stakeholders and give a platform to disenfranchised voices, conservation conflicts can also create or exacerbate schisms in communities that undermine collective action for the development of effective institutions, conservation, and the sustainable use of resources.
Given the tremendous unfolding environmental challenges faced by societies across the globe, it is imperative that we understand conservation and, more broadly, natural resource conflicts, including how they emerge and what drives them to escalate to the point that they become pathological, undermining people's ability to solve problems. Past research, including our own on conflict, has been effective but siloed in that there exists multiple lines of research on conflict, each with their own specific ontological framings. Some literature, for example, emphasizes the material aspects of conflict, such as shared resources and shared territories, but others emphasizes worldview and values. Some researchers foreground the intersection of material and political concerns, such as greed and power, or the success or failure of institutions to enable equitable outcomes. Still others take a transdisciplinary and systems-oriented approach to understanding conflict as an emergent social-ecological phenomena. These diverse framings each have their own strengths and weaknesses, but on their own, each is unlikely to provide sufficient insight for effectively managing or resolving conflicts.
Eleanor Ostrom argued that rather than looking for simple causes of problems in complex natural resource systems, we need tools to break down those systems into their varied and heterogeneous parts so that we may trace the complex interactions amongst people's needs, values, and worldviews, and contemporaneous social and ecological circumstances and trends. In this paper, we propose that what is missing from the conflict literature is a sort of diagnostic framework of the kind that Ostrom proposes, one that can support the analysis of conservation conflicts from multiple paradigms and perspectives. Importantly, we argue that such a framework must be useful to multiple users, inclusive of academic and practical applications, and it should offer a structure around which to identify and organize the central tenets of a conflict's unique story. As such, the intentionally transdisciplinary underpinnings of this synthesis is intended, in part, to highlight the broad abilities of the social sciences to offer structured, meaningful interpretation of critical phenomena, such as conservation conflicts, through the combined use of a storytelling lens and frameworks, such as this one.
Currently, there are a number of key frameworks in the conflict literature that can support actionable change and understanding of a unique conflict. Some of these frameworks and approaches to conflict focus heavily on identifying first who is involved in the conflict and what institutional approaches or interventions are already at play. Others focus first on the state of the natural resources by taking a wide view of attributes of those resources, and then followed by a similar assessment of resource users. In both of these approaches, the emphasis is placed on the who, such as who has power, the relationships, or lack thereof, between stakeholders, and the type of third-party engagement, if any, that is being used as an intervention to the conflict.
Other frameworks key into whether conservation conflicts are constructive or pathological, which offers insights into issues of trust, polarized opinions, and the status of working relationships between stakeholders. Such frameworks often include a discussion about stakeholder attitudes, but often don't explore the stakeholder values that lie behind those attitudes. Now, there are, of course, exceptions to this. Ratner et al. From 2013 discusses values, particularly how shared values in the context of the social capital available for addressing conflicts is important, and the ability or lack thereof of institutions to internalize norms and shared values. Now, others have also mentioned that shared values and perspectives are important to building trust and dialogue between decision makers and stakeholders. Though a substantial discussion of identifying shared values and building upon that existing social capital is not super prominent in this prior research.
In designing our framework, we synthesized the studies discussed here and in other academic literature on conservation conflicts. What we've done a bit differently, though, in our framework is to stage our inquiry and anchor it in a systems thinking approach. We're arguing, in other words, that the first step must be to examine the emergent nature of conflict as a whole. Conservation conflicts are dynamic, and at any given time, the presenting dispute is only one facet of the larger conflict. By first tracing the history of a conflict, perhaps even to before the conflict manifested, an analyst can understand who has been involved in the conflict and the usually dynamic state of the natural resources over time. If we look only at the most recent and escalated stage of a conflict, we are bound to miss the influence of former actors and other historic resources. Thus, for this framework, we immerse the question of who and what resource into a larger historical narrative of conflict.
Also novel in our framework is a focus on the interplay of power and knowledge, including the specifics of knowledge holders and the kinds of knowledge they bring. Power can be held in numerous ways, such as via access to data or decision makers, the privilege given different knowledge systems, and the ability to shape the broader narratives framing the issue at hand. We find that these are often missing from other frameworks, although there are exceptions. The role of scientists, researchers, and the production of scientific knowledge was discussed by several authors in our synthesis, but scientific knowledge is not apolitical. It contributes to and is shaped by people's cognitive framing of conservation and the environment. As such, local and traditional knowledge and how they do or do not factor into conflict governance is one example of how our framework attends to this aspect of conflict. Central to our framework are six features that our own past research and immersion in conflict literature have underscored as being central to understanding and managing conflict. These are 1, complexity, or the extent to which conflicts are straightforward with respect to cause and effect, and exhibit features like emergence, feedback loops, legacy effects, and so on. 2, status, with respect to whether the conflict is contributing to or detracting from effective collaboration. 3, the matter or basis of the conflict, such as resources, relationships, or processes of natural resource governance. 4, the state of knowledge, including whether the system in question is data rich or data poor, and whether science and other forms of knowledge are contested. 5, state of values, including fundamental cultural biases regarding conservation risk and ethics, and finally, 6, interventions, including identification of what has been tried before, what has sometimes not worked, and why. To make these features more useful to practitioners, we lay them out as a series of steps by which to understand a conservation conflict, and we pose a set of diagnostic questions based on these steps to better facilitate their use.
Part 2, the Conflict Diagnostic Framework. We propose here a working definition of conservation conflict as patterns of disagreement and contestation that emerge between groups with a shared stake in the conservation and use of some natural resource. We choose this definition just as a starting point, acknowledging that many definitions of conflict have been proposed that embody the specific conceptual framings of the academic disciplines from which they emerged. Now, we include a table here of a number of different definitions of conflict. Additionally, and as we will discuss in more detail in a moment, we define these conflicts as complex and emergent phenomena. That is to say, we view conflict as an escalating pattern of behavior that progressively erodes community capacity to respond to change or surprise.
The framework proposed here is the product of a synthesis of our own research experiences with conservation conflict in such diverse locales as Alaska, British Columbia, the Canadian Prairies, and even Western Europe. We link these field experiences with key literature on conflict from multiple academic fields, though inevitably we were not able to include all discussions of every relevant literature. And thus, we suggest that if you're interested, please continue to dig into additional research pertinent to your own disciplinary approach and the context of the conservation conflict of your interest.
Importantly, this paper is not intended to be a systematic review of conservation conflict literature, nor is it an attempt to develop a grand unifying theory of resource-based conflicts. What we're trying to do with this paper is to synthesize important lessons and concepts that already appear in existing case study examples, and then shape them into a useful diagnostic framework.
Our framework is presented as a series of steps that analysts, managers, and policymakers might take to diagnose conflict for the purposes of identifying root causes and planning more effective conflict management. It is ordered in a way that seems most intuitive to our own exploration of conflict case studies, and you can see that in Figure 1. And we have included diagnostic questions, which you can find in Table 4, and short case profiles after each step to highlight how concepts from each step have played out in real-world scenarios from our own research. That said, we encourage users of this framework to utilize the steps in whatever order is most effective to you. We note that this framework is intended to be explicitly reflexive with respect to acknowledging pluralism and how participants understand a conflict from within, and how outside researchers are predisposed in what we do and do not see through our own disciplinary perspectives. Specifically, we attend to the fact that scientists are not apolitical bystanders to social conflicts around natural resources, and our presence can further complicate conflicts if our work or advice is perceived to overstep or impose, or if stakeholders view us as fundamental to the root causes of the conflict. Thus, we envision that the implementation of this framework should be iterative, with periods of self-reflection on the part of those who do the analysis, and it should be done in tandem with a full complement of tools from the social sciences to tease out the diversity of perspectives that motivate people within conflicts to think and behave as they do. Step 1, complexity, emergence, and stages. Complexity highlights the importance of social and ecological histories and legacies in framing conservation conflicts and shaping how they escalate. Another way of putting this is that conflicts are rarely discrete or isolated events and are more often expressions of latent, long-standing problems or tensions among groups. To understand how and why conflicts come to be and how they change over time, some researchers draw from complex systems theory and concepts like feedback loops, slow and fast variables, or schismogenesis, a feedback loop of conflict escalation, and of course social ecological systems. For example, some conflicts can be opportunistic attempts by people seeking to gain or recover power or to address past grievances. Similarly, people may take their conflict to new arenas if they are unsuccessful at achieving change in the original arena, clashing first perhaps over, for example, how a fishery is prosecuted, and then later contesting the management regime itself.
Conservation conflicts also can be understood as being positioned along an axis of complexity, ranging from simple to wicked, with the latter involving disputes among multiple stakeholder groups that have divergent goals, define the system differently, and disagree on priorities. For simple conflicts, it is relatively easy to identify the root causes and behaviors because they are easily attributable to current events and concerns. Conservation conflicts that are anchored in deeper historical legacies, however, are more complicated because the conflict at hand is only the latest variation of an otherwise multifaceted set of tensions that may extend far beyond the conservation aspect, for example, social, political, or cultural disagreements. Ineffectually managed conflicts can change or escalate over time and in some cases to the point where conflict becomes dysfunctional and disrupts natural resource management and civil society. As such, it is essential to explore what drives this change from a constructive to dysfunctional conflict. Why, in some conflicts, are stakeholders motivated to collaborate and innovate, whereas in others, people disengage and come to mistrust, caricaturize, and perhaps even dehumanize each other?
Escalation often involves the appearance of rhetoric around winners and losers, or as Edgar et al. Have described it, discourses in which people see themselves and others in archetypal roles of heroes, victims, and villains. As escalation worsens, people stop trusting science, begin dehumanizing others, and revolt from well-established institutions, which are all aspects, of course, tied into relationships. In extreme cases, conflict escalation leads to violence. In extreme cases, conflict escalation can lead to violence. Research suggests that it can be driven by individual or simultaneously occurring factors, including inappropriate management approaches, discursive events that change the state of the resource or governing institutions, or changes in stakeholder relationships themselves. Conflict can also escalate if early stages are ignored or poorly addressed, or when people feel as though their rights are being neglected or infringed upon. Escalation can also occur where claims and counterclaims of truth and validity build upon one another over time. This positive feedback cycle can result in the original conflict becoming difficult to distinguish within a history of real or imagined slights, and actors can become more interested in maintaining their power within a conflict rather than resolving the underlying issues.
When understanding how conflicts can change and escalate, it is essential to take a historical perspective. Many conflicts have important historical dimensions, meaning that they exist on longer temporal scales than people may at first realize. Thus, an important aspect of evaluating the emergent nature of a conflict is to understand that conflict is a dynamic process that proceeds in stages, and that previous episodes of a conflict result in an aftermath that affects future episodes. In complexity science, this is known as a legacy effect. Conflicts can escalate from latent into active scenarios and reach an eventual climax and then de-escalation, and then a resulting aftermath stage. The aftermath stage may be a return to a pre-conflict equilibrium or a new stage of elevated tension where involved parties are more polarized and escalation is more easily triggered than before.
Step 2. Conflict status. As we've already discussed, conservation conflicts are dynamic. They change over time through influence from actors and events. As such, any attempt to better understand or even manage a conflict must begin from a robust assessment of that conflict's current status. Here, we found it instructive to see conflicts as existing along a spectrum from constructive to pathological, because appropriate approaches toward conflict vary depending on where a conflict sits on that spectrum. Indicators common to either side of the constructive pathological spectrum can help in that characterization, which we have listed for you in Table 2. Broadly, constructive conflicts are conflicts in which actor groups disagree but are still able to work constructively toward solutions or to work around the conflict to achieve other types of unrelated goals. Indicators of a constructive conflict include actors being willing to discuss problems, shared goals, and potential solutions. Similarly, stakeholders in constructive conflicts are often willing to compromise and buy into solutions that offer positive outcomes for all parties involved. Perhaps most important, constructive conflicts indicate that existing institutions for management and governance create an effective and ethical space for all parties to be involved in finding solutions.
If conditions occur that allow a conflict to escalate, the conflict shifts along the spectrum towards a pathological state that is increasingly destructive, intractable, and that produces negative social and environmental outcomes. Opposing groups within pathological conflicts are often increasingly polarized from one another. Solutions to core problems become framed in opposing and often binary positions, mutually exclusive to one another, forcing zero-sum or win-lose outcomes. And personal relationships with the conflict become subject to dehumanization where, quote, opposition becomes misrepresented and stereotyped, and where narratives of, quote, heroes, victims, and villains persist. Dehumanization or alienation of individuals from their interpersonal networks can destabilize people's sense of self and drive interpersonal hostility. Ultimately, these bad faith characterizations enforce an atmosphere of mistrust, both for user groups and for institutions informing the conflict, including scientific input and expertise. While conservation conflict literature frequently and reasonably takes interest in pathological conflicts, less common is a discussion of how pathological conflicts may be shifted back towards a constructive status. And we refer you here to the discussion in both Step 6 and Table 3.
Step 3. Basis for contention and cognitive framing. Understanding the matter of a conflict requires that one look first at the surface of the conflict, the matter or matters being disputed, and then look beneath that surface into the relationships, power struggles, and how parties frame the conflict through such lenses as values, ethics, and cognitive understandings of ecosystems and of cultural understandings of risk. While the material aspects are undoubtedly important, it is too easy to focus only on such matters as how many fish can be caught or how many acres of wetland must be conserved. In doing so, we would miss important human dimensions of the conflict that more fully explain why people have trouble finding compromise or agreeing on policy solutions. In part, this is because even in cases where people's values appear to be aligned, they may still disagree about the most appropriate or desirable way to achieve those outcomes. We're now going to talk about the basis of contention, which is a subsection of this whole entire section in the paper. Resource conflicts go beyond disagreement over material interests, as we've already discussed, and instead they arise from a, quote, deeper cognitive level, where stakeholders draw on their current knowledge and understanding to mentally frame a specific resource management problem. The matter of a conflict exists as a spectrum between three key variables: substance, relationships, and/or process. All three variables are important to understanding the contentions that form mental frames or ontological framing. Substance is perhaps most easily understood as the issue over which a conflict is had. Substantive aspects of a conflict can be competing, incompatible interests over a single resource, and more broadly, also represent a divergence of understanding about the nature of the resource and its broader ecological context. Substance is rarely, if ever, the only variable present in a resource conflict. Thus, understanding the process by which humans interact with the resource and the relationships that those user groups have between one another rather than just with the resource itself are both really essential pieces. Now let's talk about process. Process relates to decision-making and includes aspects of equity, power, and which individuals or institutions wield it, and how decision-making processes are organized and executed. Process is especially important because it can affect how conflicting parties are able to make and accept decisions. Parties are more likely to reject decisions, even decisions that address their original substantial concerns, if they feel that the decision was reached in an inequitable or was exclusive of their input. Similarly, parties are more likely to accept decisions that do not necessarily match their views or desired outcomes if they feel that that process to arrive at those decisions was equitable and executed appropriately. Moving now to relationships. Relationships are important aspects of conflicts, though they are sometimes difficult to characterize and understand from an outside point of view. Relationships are comprised of aspects like trust and respect, personal and group identity, and exist over a spectrum of strength, from strong to weak to broken or to non-existent relationships. While relationships are commonly considered as being between human actors, the relationships between human and non-human actors, such as a species or a landscape that their person might be in, those are inclusive of concepts like justice and equity for human and non-human actors, and so they're also relevant to discussions of conflict.
The influence of relationships on conflict is often poorly understood, ignored, or otherwise avoided by both institutions seeking to address the conflict, as well as by the stakeholders engaged in the conflict themselves. Important to this is the role of powerful individuals within conflict coalitions, and understanding that conflicts between high-powered actors that can be disruptive to management interventions. This is an important weakness to address, as strong relationships and the time spent developing them may reap dividends by bridging conflicting parties and creating the basis for social change and progress. Finally, substance, process, and relationships should all be considered across scales. While conflicts are frequently localized, not all potential stakeholders or exacerbating variables will necessarily be local. Thus, the scale of knowledge available to inform a case should be appropriate to its context, see step 4, and these three aspects of a conflict should be considered across regional, national, and international scales.
Now let's go to the next part of this step, cognitive framing. Cognitive framing can be considered in two ways. One, the relationships that define the conflict, whether that's between human-wildlife or human-human, and two, the cognitive boundaries and lenses through which a conflict is understood. In this framework, the first definition is generally pretty straightforward, so we focus our energy on addressing a discussion of the second. Resource conflicts arise in part because resource users and stakeholders have differentiating understandings of the resource, its value, and its social and ecological context. That is, what and who resources are for, and how and by what benchmarks they ought to be managed. How people see the resource system as working and the needs, values, and or ideologies that drive potentially competing positions on these issues all compose their ontological frame of the resource. Ontology, generally, describes the lens through which one views reality, where different lenses will make apparent different understandings of the same subject. This can involve, for example, different understandings of how risk manifests, how ecosystems function, the role of people in creating environmental problems, and even ethical predispositions about how and on what basis decisions ought to be made. In practice, ontological framings have been described as paradigms, cultural models, and social constructions, just to name a few. When considering conflicts, multiple competing ontologies of a resource can be difficult to recognize since they are held internally by each stakeholder who may or may not be cognizant of their mental frame. Understanding ontological framing is important for excavating the underlying matter of a conflict, and there is no one right theoretical framework to unpack such complex ideas. That being said, several strong options for understanding mental frames do exist, including cultural theory of risk, cognitive hierarchy theory, and cognitive ecologies.
Step 4, the state of knowledge. Identifying the states of knowledge within a resource conflict is valuable for identifying both knowledge gaps and how knowledge is currently being used. In our own research on conflict, we have frequently observed calls by stakeholder groups for improving biological and ecological knowledge, though increasingly, studies have pointed out that even in cases rich in natural science knowledge may be missing a key social or governance information. This gap sometimes occurs because the basis of contention in conflicts is assumed to be the material of the resource itself, rather than multifaceted and inclusive of social aspects. It is reasonable for parties in a resource conflict to desire improved knowledge, as a lack of information forces managers, policymakers, and resource users to operate in a state of uncertainty. Stakeholders, too, want to make choices based on clear, rigorously collected knowledge rather than opinion or anecdote. While perfect information is practically impossible in real-world scenarios, uncertainty can be reduced by filling critical case and context-dependent knowledge gaps, and empirically produced knowledge is only one means of achieving this. However, it is important to differentiate between the need for new knowledge production or if clarifying contested existing knowledge is more appropriate. Efforts to generate new knowledge are unlikely to be successful if the objectives, means of interpreting new knowledge, and sense of shared credibility are not agreed on by all stakeholders. Similarly, it is also important that not only are multiple knowledge subjects pursued, but also different ontologies and types of knowledge are. Local and traditional ecological knowledge systems are often overlooked, excluded, and poorly understood and thus poorly incorporated in Western model resource management and governance regimes. Though good examples of using multiple knowledge sets to further collective aims exist, knowledge generation and evidence-based intervention should be born from a variety of sources, and thus the multiple knowledge types and means of producing knowledge should be also sought to address critical knowledge gaps through credible means.
Knowledge generation itself does not guarantee improved outcomes for resource conflicts. Data collection must be appropriately matched with resources for analysis, have clear objectives that are preferably linked to equitable and just change outcomes, and communication, that is, a two-way communication in which information is discussed rather than prescribed, between policymakers, managers, the public, and resource users is also key. Worth noting, however, is that improved information, particularly when linked to policy outcomes, can sort of force decision-making into binary win-lose outcomes. These outcomes can often exacerbate conflict, and so using increased knowledge to evaluate both the risks of change as well as the risks of doing nothing is worth considering. This option, where multiple, perhaps competing views about a resource that present low social and ecological risk, but simultaneously can keep stakeholders engaged in a constructive conflict, that option might be preferable to implementing only one understanding of a resource. Given these considerations, cases where the available knowledge base is poor or absent offers a good opportunity for the use of participatory and adaptive research approaches aimed at reaching shared design, implementation, interpretations of findings, and eventually actionable outcomes. Though these approaches can be time and energy consuming, the opportunity to keep stakeholders engaged in constructive conflict and reach outcomes acceptable to all parties should not be undervalued considering the alternatives. Examples of participatory adaptive management, co-management, cross-coalition learning all show that stakeholder engagement in science can be achieved, though such processes can become meaningless if they fall victim to prevailing policy or power interests, are overly formulaic and lack genuine interest in participation, misuse non-dominant knowledge sets, or are used as a means to achieve a predetermined end.
Step 5, the state of values. Differences in beliefs, values, and normative perceptions of a resource have been identified in multiple typologies as the basis for why conflicts occur. Similarly, recognition of shared belief and, quote, cognitive common ground has been shown as an essential first step to conflict resolution, management, and intervention. Shared values have been shown to exist even in highly pathological and contentious conflicts, and even if perceived difference between groups is significant. We define shared and contested values as the following. Shared values are those values upon which stakeholders agree to be important, for example, having the opportunity to fish, even if they'd agree on their relative priorities or specific approaches to achieving those values, such as harvest restrictions or quotas. Now, contested values, on the other hand, are values that stakeholders either A, disagree upon, for example, some user groups should have prioritized access to fishing, or know that they disagree on, or B, directly disagree upon, for example, that salmon produced by hatcheries are, quote, less natural than salmon produced in the wild. And here, contested values means that people do not recognize the basis for disagreement. In this example about the wildness of fresher hatchery salmon, it's the different underlying ontologies of nature and human nature interactions. Importantly, these values are not binary opposites, or even opposing sides of the same spectrum. Rather, they may be implicitly held or poorly understood by stakeholders. In evaluating a conflict, understanding shared and contested values is essential to building common ground, shared frames of reference, and identifying mutually acceptable ways forward.
Step 6, interventions. Conservation conflicts are dynamic and contextual by nature, and as such, no single framework can prescribe a particular intervention. Instead, the steps of this framework are intended to highlight multiple points of intervention or places of tension where interventions may be most effectively focused. One such focus among practitioners who have taken the time and effort to understand a conflict is to be able to select and apply an appropriate intervention. As conflict is often complex, ongoing, and may have no path toward complete resolution, approaches toward conflict management instead of outright resolutions may be more successful in meeting stakeholder objectives. Thus, previously tried interventions should be evaluated for what the original desired outcomes were, and whether that was respective of the issues raised in the previous steps of this framework, and whether those outcomes or metrics of success were shared by all parties to the conflict, and of course, whether those interventions succeeded or failed by those measures. Interventions are typically technical, political, or cultural in nature, each of which are linked to and generally address three bases for contention: substance, process, and relationships, though some authors have expanded this typology to include economic, cognitive, enforcement, and stakeholder categories. For any of these intervention approaches to be successful, attention should be paid to where a proposed intervention originates. That is, whether the intervention represents a collaboratively derived way forward, was developed by one powerful group of stakeholders, comes from the public or private sector of stakeholders, etc. And also, how it was communicated to stakeholders. Intervention proposals that originate through exclusive processes where not all stakeholders are included or heard can face strong opposition as a result. Similarly, the means by which the intervention is implemented and communicated may also exacerbate conflict. Top-down interventions that involve little to no local input or agency have the potential to prolong conflict. As such, an important development in conservation conflict management has been the move towards stakeholder involvement in collaborative models of resource management, research, governance, and engagement. Important to the consideration of interventions are the temporal scales over which they take place. Resource conflicts may involve fast or slow variables, or variables that occur and induce change at different speeds and thus impact the conflict scenario in different, sometimes difficult to predict ways. As managers, politicians, and public stakeholders who are operating on shorter time periods, such as like an election cycle, or under crisis, such as an environmental catastrophe, are more likely to address fast variables with superficial and short-term interventions, and slow variables therefore may go unnoticed or unaddressed, leading to long-term and perhaps unintended consequences. Thus, it is important to take the time to assess the presence of fast and slow variables in a conflict and choose both the type and timing of interventions so as to act effectively across temporal scales.
Part 3, mandates, policy, and conflict management. Now, with this conflict framework, we've proposed a pragmatic approach to capturing all epistemological aspects of conflict, its objective and socially constructed, and subjective dimensions. These dimensions are interconnected with linkages and overlaps that are important and intentional. Recognizing and understanding the kinds of knowledge that these different dimensions entail will require research from different disciplines and approaches that operate from multiple epistemological and ontological framings. For example, whereas positivist research can elucidate the material dimensions of a conflict, critical research approaches such as political ecology are necessary to fully unpack the bases for contention, and phenomenological approaches are necessary to explore the mental models and subjective ways that people experience and develop values around contested resources. Thus, operationalizing frameworks like this one should be undertaken in a team-based, interdisciplinary, and long-term manner. The synthesis of information leads us to a significant challenge, identifying which of the many tools and approaches available in conservation conflict literature that we should apply, and then how to actually utilize them in addressing a real-world case. We argue that a robust understanding of the systemic, historical, and ontological dimensions of national resource conflict is essential to effective conflict management. Still, from a manager's perspective, knowledge that a conflict is rooted in, say, inequality or institutional failure may be of little help when implementing solutions. That's because resource managers often must work with very specific statutory mandates, such as science-based management or sustained yield. In the case of Alaska fisheries, for example, area fisheries managers are limited in their ability to take human dimensions into account when making recommendations to open or close a fishery, as they are required to act within the boundaries of existing management plans. They can also be limited in the kind of data they can incorporate into their decisions and recommendations, for example, traditional and local ecological knowledge. Likewise, issues regarding how fish are allocated and whether people's rights are being protected fall instead to local political bodies, such as the state's Board of Fisheries, or, in extreme cases, to the state and federal courts.
As such, inasmuch as this framework offers a way to look beneath conflicts, it also requires that those interested in conflict management look at the existing landscape of governance to determine which aspects of a conflict can be addressed at the management or regulatory level, which are best addressed by an impartial third party, and which may require new policies or collaborative governance approaches. If the goal is, for example, to reconnect conflicting parties through their shared values, then third-party organizations that can work as honest brokers are likely essential. But if the central driver of conflict is a failure of existing management policies to achieve some degree of equity in the benefits and harms across all state stake and rights holder groups, then change through legislation in the courts may be necessary until existing regulations leave enough room for flexible reinterpretation and responsiveness to context-specific conditions. Now, alternatively, the very priorities of managers might be reimagined to center around social and ecological justice, equity, and the core principles of conservation. A transition that would require innovation and collaboration at multiple levels of governance and stakeholder participation and, of course, a degree of privilege to work where all other social ecological needs are met so as to have the space, so to speak, to focus on those goals. Though we argue that the goals and stories we share in constructing this framework are useful across disciplines, we acknowledge that they are also based in developed, well-funded sectors where our suggested approaches are generally feasible, but which may not be the case in other contexts. To conclude with a broader view on this framework, we draw from Madden and McQuinn in their 2014 paper where they said, conservation setbacks often stem from a lack of consideration of the full spectrum of conflict. We push this idea of conflict as a spectrum a step further in this framework, and we offer the notion of conflict as story. The complexities of conflict highlight the value in framing conservation conflicts as stories, particularly in how conflicts can be understood as a larger, ongoing narrative with depth, meaning, and containing complex and interrelated storylines that could be told from multiple perspectives, resulting in different understandings of reality.
Social scientists are uniquely positioned to be producers of more than empirical data, but also facilitators of meaning and stories about our subjects. With conservation conflict science, we suggest that shifting our frames of thinking from, quote, conflicts as problems to, quote, conflicts as stories will allow a more intuitive understanding of not only the basic elements of a conflict, but also how those elements have or have not interacted together over time. This framework offers the scaffolding on which to examine the story of a conservation conflict from transdisciplinary perspectives, particularly in how it positions the emergent nature of a conflict, or how did the story begin, as an entry point to understanding. It is our hope that managers, academics, and other stakeholders will find this framing useful in dissecting, analyzing, and understanding the variant parts of a conflict in order to select and apply appropriate solutions.
Thanks for listening to Pubcasts. Today's paper was entitled Seen Beneath Disputes, a Transdisciplinary Framework for Diagnosing Complex Conservation Conflicts, written by Hannah L. Harrison and Philip A. Loring at the University of Guelph. This paper was published in the journal Biological Conservation in 2020. To hear more Pubcasts, visit the Coastal Roots Project website at www.coastalroots.org. That's www.coastalroots.org. And hey, thanks for listening. Please connect with us on Twitter. You can find our Twitter information and other social media handles in the description of this podcast.